It's a beautiful Monday in Dallas, and I am delighted to welcome all of you to our Faith and Business Luncheon. My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the Dean at Perkins School of Theology, and delighted to welcome you to this April Faith and Business Luncheon. A number of you greeted me with the word that when you heard who our speakers were going to be, you wanted to be sure to be here today. And I know that we're in for a treat with a conversation lies ahead. Come on in. The thing I want to say is while I continue to talk, please continue with your lunch. Do not interrupt your meal. We want to be respectful of your time in every way and certainly want you to enjoy the lunch. I am going to introduce you to one of our students here at Perkins School of Theology. Rosalia Johnson is a second-year Master of Divinity student here at Perkins, and she is going to offer our invocation. Rosalia?
Let us pray. Dear God, ruler of the universe, who has created us, sustained us, and brought us together this day, we thank you and we honor you. We seek blessings on the task before us with connecting faith and business. Bless our efforts with clear insight, our deliberations with wisdom, and our work with clarity and accuracy. Guide us, O God, with understanding and with wisdom. And may our personal faith give us strength to serve you, our world, our nation, and our community. Help us to work together to understand the differences forged in the fires of our experiences. And as we move forth in our daily lives, we just ask that you allow us to move with the confidence and the integrity that you displayed and that you have given us. Bless the threads, God, that bind us together. In the name of God, the infinitely compassionate and merciful. Amen.
Thank you very much, Rosalia. The concept of these faith and business luncheons began as an idea that was generated within a small group of friends and supporters of Perkins School of Theology. Specifically, two people were responsible for the original idea. Dodie Crockett, who is one of the co-chairs of our campaign steering committee here at Perkins, and John Castle. And I am going to invite John to come up and share with you just a few brief reflections about the nature of the faith and business luncheon concept. John?
Thank you, Dean. Well, appreciate it very much. Welcome, everybody. We're glad to have you all here. And I guess this is the end of our third year of having these luncheons. Began, as the dean said, began with breakfast with Dodie and the dean and I having breakfast together and reflecting on the mission of Perkins. We know that Perkins has a wonderful group of academics. Some of us have been exposed to the teaching of those professors over the years. We know it prepares all kinds of students for different types of ministry. But also Perkins has this wonderful mission to serve the laity, to make sure that they're preparing faithful men and women to go out and engage the world and bring their faith into their workplaces, into their work environment, and do it in a way of integrity and with a certain kind of satisfaction. And so as we discussed that kind of mission that Perkins had, we began to think of this idea that what if we gathered and had distinguished people like Arena Peterson come and reflect on their faith, and reflect on how their faith informs and transforms their workplaces and the work that they do. As I began to take my faith more seriously in the early 90s when I was at EDS, I began to look around and think about how separate our workplaces were from our faith lives. And it seemed to me that's not what we were called to do. That's not what the deepest sense of who we are as being God's people to try to think that or imagine that we live out our lives Monday through Friday without reference to the God that we worship. So I began to look for models or want to hear stories of how other people were doing that, people that were faithful people. And there were some, but not very many. But that's changed over time. And we thought having this kind of forum, have these kind of people like Rena come and reflect on that would be a good inspiration for each one of us to think more seriously about how we're living out our faith and what we do on a day-to-day basis to reflect the call that God has on our lives. So that's kind of what we're about. We hope and pray that these luncheons are an inspiration for you, informative for you, and deepen your journey with your God. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, John. Your remarks are a reminder, lest we need a reminder, that today is the beginning, actually yesterday, the beginning of Holy Week for Christians in preparation for the coming events that culminate on Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and then next Sunday with the celebration of Easter. And for those Christians who are persons from the Western tradition, Roman Catholic tradition, most of the Protestant traditions, this is Holy Week. And for one of those rare occasions of convergence, for those of you who are Christians but from the Eastern tradition, Orthodox tradition, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, etc., this is also your Holy Week. It's one of those infrequent opportunities for the calendars to coincide. It is, of course, also the beginning of the season of Passover. And therefore, the journey of faith groups who travel separate paths of practice, but shared practice of belief. This is an important week for us, and today an important day for us together to host this Faith and Business Luncheon. There are a couple of persons whom I want to have you greet and acknowledge. Let me start by inviting Bob Irish to stand. Bob is here in the room somewhere. Well, let's give Bob, in whatever part of the world he's in, a round of applause and thanks. He sponsored today's luncheon. He's why your lunch is free. I also want you to greet the chair of the Board of Trustees of Southern Methodist University, Karen Prothro. Karen. And a very special guest who is with us today is the Vice President for Student Affairs at Southern Methodist University, Dr. Lori White. And in case you don't know, Lori is about a month away from being a bride. She's going to get married next month. Yeah, and Tony is in his office preparing for the wedding, I hope. Yeah, all right, okay. All right. Great to see you, Lori. I am going to introduce both of our speakers, and then they will get up in turn, each making remarks for approximately 20 minutes. And then after we've heard from both of our speakers, Todd Raspberry will help facilitate the time that's available for questions following the two presentations. It is possible that neither of these persons needs an introduction, and yet some of us who are in the room know one speaker a little better than the other. Let me tell you a bit about each. Rena Peterson is a seasoned voice for women, a respected newspaper journalist, a popular author, and by her own self-description at a recent Bush Institute event on Afghan women, a self-described recovering journalist. For 9 years, she served as a member of the Pulitzer Prize board. She has herself been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Editorial page editor at the Dallas Morning News for 16 years, she won multiple headliner awards. She was profiled by PBS as a pioneer for women journalists, along with Judy Woodruff and Anna Quinlan. She is currently Director of Communications for the American College of Education and helps to establish American colleges worldwide. She has written two books, the first of them called What Next? Women Redefining Their Dreams in the Prime of Life, and the second, What's Missing? Inspiration for Women Seeking Faith and Joy in Their Lives. The latter of them, by the way, was assisted by one of our faculty members, Joette Bassler, now retired. She has in her professional life written profiles of women who have played significant roles in our society, ranging from former First Lady Laura Bush to television anchor Diane Sawyer to journalist Peggy Noonan to singer and songwriter Judy Collins. She holds a baccalaureate degree with honors from the University of Texas. It's a BS in journalism. She earned a master's degree from Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism in New York. And she has recently been named by Columbia as a distinguished alumna of the graduate school. She is a member of a number of international organizations and national organizations that include the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and she is, as many of us know, an active civic volunteer in the community. She is a member of Holland Park United Methodist Church, and somewhere along the line, she found the time to become the mother of two sons, Gregory and Gish. Rena has been featured on CNN, on The O'Reilly Factor, on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Glad she got that one in before Oprah retired. And she's been on Good Morning America. Audiences around the country have heard Rena's remarks, her speeches, have read her books, and know that she is a tremendously accomplished professional. She is also a person of deep faith. We know that she came back to Dallas after having served a tour of duty as U.S. Undersecretary for Diplomacy, Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs beginning in 2006 when she worked with Karen Hughes. We're delighted to welcome back Rena Peterson, who is also a member of Perkins Campaign Steering Committee. Please join me in welcoming her. Thank you, Rena, for that inspiring speech. Yeah. Our second speaker, who will immediately follow Rena, is Dr. Sika Wan. Sika is professor of New Testament here at Perkins School of Theology. He teaches specifically in the areas that involve the writings of Paul. He's currently at work on a major research project regarding the Book of Romans. He is a scholar of post-colonial studies and of Second Temple Judaism. He came to the United States from his native China to study, earned his undergraduate degree at Brandeis University, then went to Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, where he earned a Master of Divinity degree, and then he went on to Harvard University, where he earned a Ph.D., focusing, of course, on New Testament studies. When I greeted him, by the way, asked him if he were ready for today, said, what am I doing here today? And he, of course, caught me off guard. But I then told him I thought he was going to do a language training program for all of us in Mandarin. He said, actually, I could do that easily. But I think we'll have him do something else today. His publications are extraordinary. I'll just mention a few titles: Power in Weakness, Conflict and Rhetorics in Paul's Second Letter to the Corinthians, The Bible in Modern China, Literary and Intellectual Impact, Betwixt and Between, Toward a Hermeneutics of Hyphenation, which may sound more technical than you want to know, but it's actually extraordinary work. And then I'll mention, finally, Abraham and the Promise of Spirit, Points of Convergence, between Philo and Paul. He is a technical scholar in the best sense of the word, an extraordinary colleague, and an amazing teacher about whom our students rave. He is also an ordained priest in the Episcopal Church, a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Biblical Literature, and a contributor to the New Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. I promise he will speak to us in English today. Please join me in greeting Sika Wan. Now, Rena, we are in your hands.
Thank you so much, Dean. Okay, me again. It is a special honor to be here among so many good and faithful friends, and an honor to be on the program with CCAR. Truly a great privilege. Since this series is about faith and business, I thought I'd talk today about how my Christian faith has informed my life as a journalist and vice versa. I started work at newspapers when I was 16, when I was a junior in high school. I started work at my hometown paper, the San Angelo Standard Times, affectionately known as the San Angelo Slandered Times. I've been fortunate that my years as a journalist have given me the chance to interview people all over the world about what mattered in their lives, how they navigated the difficulties that they encountered, what they had learned. Being a journalist, you know, is kind of like having a license to be nosy, like Columbo. You get to go up and talk to people about their lives, and I was fortunate to get to learn from a very wide range of people about what they did and what they learned. I wasn't kidding when I told Todd Rasberry that the subtitle for my talk should be Everything I Learned About Faith, I Learned from Scripture, Newspapers, and Cartoons in the New Yorker. And I'm going to try to show you what I mean. People sometimes ask me who was my favorite of all the people I've interviewed, and it's a really tough choice, from Lucille Ball to Ronald Reagan, from Margaret Thatcher to Fidel Castro. But I have to admit, my favorite was Julia Child. I had tried for months to reach her, and I couldn't get a hold of her because at 85, she was still traveling around the world, gallivanting around, having a great time with her wonderful zest for life. And one Friday afternoon, I thought, well, I'll try again. Tried her number. I thought it was her secretary's number, and somebody picked up the phone and said, hello? And I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got her. I explained. I was really interested. I was in Dallas. I was writing a book about women, and could I interview her? And she said, have at it. Have a go. You've got me. One of the things that I loved about Julia Child was that she was so unaffected by her fame. She would say things like, well, I was lucky I got to go to France. I was lucky the women in France shared their recipes with me. That the Kennedys were in the White House and French cooking was the cat's pajamas. But, of course, luck was only part of it. She had the moxie to take on French cooking at midlife and the nerve to go on public TV with a cooking show when no one else was doing that. And she revolutionized American cooking and public TV in the process. When she first walked into the studio at WGBH in Boston, all 62 of her, she brought along some cooking pans and some food from her own kitchen, and she lined the three naked chickens up on the TV stage and introduced them to viewers as Miss Broiler, Miss Roaster, and Miss Fryer. Well, the critics just roasted her, but the audience loved her because she wasn't afraid to be herself. That was her charm. Once she was asked why she didn't give up cooking with butter, and she scoffed, Picker, people who don't like butter have lank hair and no sense of humor. She had simply a marvelous sense of humor herself. Once she was cooking a souffle, and when she pulled it out and announced with a ta-ta, it fell into a puddle. Just a little pile of soup. She looked at it a minute, and then she just broke out laughing until tears were running down her cheeks. And I thought, well, of course, that's right. We should all laugh when our souffles fall, because, of course, they do. We should all expect puddles, because there will be some. And Julia was living proof that she who laughs, lasts. And indeed she did. One time she was cooking something, I've forgotten what it was, but it fell off the pot, and she just reached down and picked it up and came back up on the TV screen and threw it in the pot and said, well, it wasn't there long. Now, to me, that was a great lesson in life, that if you're down on the floor, don't stay there long. Get up. Get on with it. And often that's what Julia Child did, whatever her disappointments were. When I asked her about her faith, she said her faith consisted of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, Matthew 7:12. And it showed. Even though she was in the public eye for decades, you won't find a negative word about her. Have you ever seen anything negative about Julia Child? I look. You won't find it, which is really remarkable, really amazing. I'm sure she didn't consider herself a wisdom figure or a role model or a teacher, but the truth is we all teach with our lives. As St. Francis of Assisi put it, preach the gospel at all times. Use words if necessary. So we all learn from each other as well as from what we read and do, and I have just been fortunate to learn from some very extraordinary people. I learned a wonderful prayer from Alma Powell, the wife of Secretary of State Colin Powell, who taught me a prayer that she learned from a minister and uses every day. It's real simple to learn. I taught it to my sons. You use the fingers on your hand. The first finger, your thumb, where you begin, is praise for God, because that's always first. Put God first. The second finger, the index finger, is to give thanks. Always give thanks for your blessings and for your problems, because you benefit from both. The middle finger, the tallest finger, is forgiveness, because that's so key. We have to practice forgiveness for others and forgiveness for ourselves. The next to the last finger is your prayers for others. And the last finger, the smallest finger, is your prayers for yourself. Last, not first. I thought it was just a wonderful prayer. I learned a lot from talking to Alma Powell, and I've learned something from everyone that I've interviewed, although some of them might surprise you. Over the years, I interviewed Candy Bar the stripper many times. How many of you remember Candy Bar the stripper? Okay, showing your age here. Those who are younger, those who are younger, she was a stripper, a porn star. She made a famous stag film. They called them stag films back then. Now they're just rated R and X. She ended up consorting with mobsters like Mickey Cohen. But she also wrote poetry and preferred living quietly in Brownwood, Texas, to being in front of the bright lights of nightclubs. We talked on the phone several times in the 1970s when I was a young reporter for UPI, because Jack Ruby had visited her a few months before he shot Lee Harvey Oswald, and so she was dragged back into the headlines and interviewed by the FBI and the police multiple times and by reporters like me. But over the years, I benefited much from our phone interviews, usually on a clunky black rotary phone down in the basement at UPI while I was working the night shift as a newcomer. And I learned that, like many exotic dancers, that she was sexually abused as a very young girl. Her mother had died when she was 9 years old, and she was sexually abused by a neighbor and a babysitter. So when she was 13, she fled her degrading circumstances for Dallas, but she never really escaped. At 14, she married a petty crook and drifted into dancing and prostitution. She claimed she was drugged when she made an infamous porn film in a motel called Smart Aleck at the age of 15. Her real name was Juanita Dale Slusher, which is not nearly as glamorous as Candy Bar. But she was the Anna Nicole Smith of her day, a bad girl that the bad boys and the cameras loved. She became famous for wearing skinny panties and cowboy boots. When they hauled her off to prison in Texas, they had arrested her for stashing a marijuana cigarette into her bra. As they took her away, she quipped to the crowd around. She said, "Well, I always wanted a brick house of my own, and it looks like I'm going to have one." I asked her if prison was hard, and she said, "Well, no, actually, she was happy in prison because she finally got to take the high school classes that she had never had. She sang in the prison choir and played in the band. She was no angel. She had shot one ex-husband in the stomach, explaining that actually she had missed. She was aiming for his groin." She had this honesty and this humanity that was very compelling and somewhat redeeming. I never forgot that glimpse of life, the story behind the story of the seamy side of life. So turned out one of my first front page stories that I did for the Dallas Morning News was about the social pathology of prostitution in Dallas. Any of you prostitutes at the Fairmount and prostitutes that lived in low-income areas, and the managing editor just loved it. he decided he would put it top of the fold in the Sunday paper, the biggest circulation paper with photos. So he had it all laid out. It was very eye-catching. It was a picture of a prostitute with a very in the shadows with a very provocative come hither look, and her pimp, her John, standing further off in the shadows. It was very progressive for its time. So progressive, in fact, that on the Sunday morning it rained. My phone rang at about 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was the managing editor, and he said, "I don't think you better come in tomorrow." He said, "We've had thousands of calls. We have had hundreds of subscriptions canceled. People in Dallas aren't ready to read about prostitution with their cereal on a Sunday." So my little effort to explain the social pathology behind prostitution got off to a rocky start, but I didn't give up. I kept writing about it for many years. I had to duck the executive editor in the hall for a long time after that. But I often wrote about it, and at one point I wrote about a little group called Amy's Friends, which later became New Friends, New Life, which helps exotic dancers start their life over and get over the street. And I was pleased to attend a luncheon last week where my friend Harriet Myers was the keynote speaker to a huge ballroom full of people at the Hyatt. And so I think Dallas has come a long way in understanding that some of these social pathologies are very complicated issues. They're not simple. But what I learned from all of those experiences was to judge less and to help more. And that's the cue for our first New Yorker cartoon, and we'll see if I can do technology. I picked this cartoon because that's me. I've made mistakes. I'm sure you've made mistakes. Probably some people's mistakes are just more colorful than others, and some end up in the newspaper. I was lucky that I got to run corrections in the paper for some of mine. We don't always get to run a correction, but that's when prayers like Alma Powell's come in handy to forgive and to seek forgiveness. One of the most unexpected highlights and insights in my career came from, of all people, Fidel Castro, and I put this story in here for my friend Ruben. I had interviewed him along with a group of American editors in 1998. The Cuban dictator was 72 then. Ruben and I were figuring out a little while ago, he's about 85 now. But he was still vigorous enough to talk nonstop for 6 hours. He talked so long that I ran out of space in my notebook, front and back page, and I had to take notes on the back of my checks in my checkbook because I didn't want to miss a word. I knew any minute now he was going to say the thing that was the headline in the story. He talked on trying to justify his stranglehold on the island and kind of having fun with the visiting gringo editors from the north. He was by turns charming and chilling. His charisma was evident, but so was his blood-stained past. We were well aware of the poverty of the island. It was all around us. We knew the stories about the poets and the journalists who were put in prison and tortured. We knew about the political rivals who had been murdered or vanquished. Afterwards, I went up to him, and I knew that he had attended a Jesuit high school. So I asked him if he still retained any of his religious beliefs from his early days in Jesuit school, just to be a little imp. I just had to ask. So I asked him, I said, "Do you pray?" He looked very surprised, and he said with something of a bemused look that he often thought positive thoughts for people, and he asked, "Isn't that the same thing?" And I said, "No, because you left God out of the process. You're not God." He laughed a little bit and enjoyed the process and the exchange. I don't think anybody had ever asked him about that. He seemed very intrigued about the reminder of his Jesuit days. He said he would never forget the way that one of his Jesuit teachers tried to describe hell to him. He said the priest had compared it to a mechanical bird, a mechanical iron bird, that must forever peck at a massive steel ball over and over again, without making a dent in it, without being able to fly away, with no appreciable change, no hope, no release, just meaningless limbo. It was a very vivid, surreal image. I've got to admit, I've never heard an image of hell exactly like that. And later it struck me that the people in Cuba were struck in pretty much a meaningless limbo like that, to a joyless place with no hope as long as he was in charge. He seemed to enjoy our conversation. After he told the story about the mechanical bird in hell, he laughed and shook his head as if to say, oh, but he had dismissed that kind of religious hokum years before. But it was clear the metaphor had stayed with him. And when I read the reports about his ill health, I often wonder, well, I wonder if he's thinking about what might be in store for him, if he remembers the story about the mechanical bird and what hell might be like. Even Fidel at some point has to acknowledge that you can run, but you can't hide. Sooner or later, you have to come to terms with the life that you have lived. And I will say that all the people that I've interviewed, particularly when I wrote a book about women changing direction at midlife, all of those women, and men too, have had a lot of life happen to them. You don't survive a couple of decades without a life happening to you. One woman that I interviewed memorably put it, life just ain't always a ride on a pink duck. And it's true. We all spend our time in the rodeo barrel taking our knocks. I know I have. I know you have. So here's our next cartoon. If you can't read that, it's the minister saying, having completed the formation of the earth, on the seventh day the Lord rested. Then on the eighth day the Lord said, let there be problems. And there were problems. Ann Landers once said that the most important advice that she ever gave was to expect trouble as an inevitable part of life. And when it comes, she said, hold your head up high, look it squarely in the eye and say, I will be bigger than you. You cannot defeat me. Then to repeat to yourself the most comforting of words, this too will pass. When I was researching that book on women who had changed their life at midlife, I was really struck by how many of them said having a spiritual foundation was very important to navigating the change and the problems that they had encountered in their life. About 80% of them said their faith, whatever their religion or their denomination, was indispensable. And it's true. We all need a compass to show us the way. We all need a gyroscope to help us keep our balance. But I was also struck that the majority of the women said one of their favorite scriptures was Jeremiah 29:11-13. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to give you hope in a future. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. That's the great thing about faith. It does give you perspective and hope and comfort and joy to know there's someone on the other end of the phone line, someone who's on your side. That book was intended to be a secular book for a secular audience, but so many of the people spoke about their faith that their faith became an important part of the book, and I was really glad that it was. Not all the people that I interviewed for that book were famous or infamous, as in Candy Bar. A good example was Donna Sanson, who lived in Charleston, D.C., South Carolina. She had survived widowhood and a devastating financial situation. Her husband had left her saddled with huge debts that she didn't even know that they had. She worked as a school teacher and then as a manager in the children's department of a department store to support her two children. But she didn't like the way the store treated their customers. They were rude to the customers. They didn't respect their customers. So she left, took a job in Mississippi as the administrator of a school nutrition program. She didn't know anything about nutrition, but she learned. But over time, she didn't really like the way the people in that county office treated their own employees. They didn't treat their own employees with kindness. She was having lunch with her son one day in a nice restaurant with good food and a nice ambiance. And she said, you know what I'd really like to do is to start a restaurant like this, where people will be happy to come in and happy when they leave. And her son said, well, why don't you? So she wrote a letter to her church and said, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. Will you pray on this and see if it's God's will that I do this? One of the members of the church gave the letter to a friend. Turned out she went to high school with Donna Sanson. She had enough money to give to Donna Sanson to start the little business. She bought a storefront in a really horrible part of town called Catfish Alley, the kind of place that was surrounded by bars and run-down apartments. She got the Mennonite community to bake the bread. She hired the wives at the Air Force Base to work in the restaurant. And opened up business, and she put a scripture over each door. She put Zechariah 4:6, not by night, not by power, but by the Spirit. And sure enough, the restaurant was a big hit from day one. She treated the guests, the customers, like guests in her own home. She treated her employees like family, or maybe a little better. The restaurant had a really good feel to it, as well as good food. And pretty soon, she was doing so well, she was able to add an expansion and a patio. New businesses began coming to Catfish Alley. The neighborhood started picking up. New apartments were built. Change happened. And it wasn't just because of the turtle fudge pie. Something was at work. She told me that even when she was too tired to get out of bed and felt her age and felt her arthritis, that she knew in her heart, and this is her quote, "When we're all dead and gone, nothing will matter except the people we have touched in a positive way. Otherwise, what did I do with my life that was significant? My children, certainly. But it's the people you touch, ultimately, that's all that matters." And it's true. Over the 30 years that I worked for newspapers as a recovering journalist, I wrote a lot of editorials about, in columns, about things that I thought were important, from nuclear disarmament to water rights to quite a few women's issues to prison reform. But you know, the thing that people often mention that they remember the most are the columns that I wrote to my sons about life, and a column about Harry Reasoner and Christmas that I reprinted several times because I loved it so much. I thought that column by Harry Reasoner, actually it was a broadcast on 60 Minutes, was one of the most elegant explanations of the meaning of Christmas that I had ever read. And I was a TV critic then and ran it in my TV column. People came up to me for years and said, "I couldn't believe you wrote about your faith in a TV column." And I thought, well, why not? Why not? It's a big part of life. It should be somewhere besides in the religion page. So I've included it in your handouts today because I think it's actually a very elegant testimony for Easter as well. So I thought you might enjoy having that. As for the columns about my sons, I did those, quite frankly, on days when I couldn't think of anything else to write about. And I would put in their advice that I never had time to give my sons, you know, and some not exactly wisdom for the ages, like, never fry bacon without your clothes on. But some of it actually was pretty good advice and almost theological. Like, when you're at your wit's end, that's where you will find God waiting for you. It was the kind of mix of good humor and theology because I actually think they're very related. The most impressive person I've ever interviewed, my favorite is Joey Chong, but the most impressive person I've ever interviewed was Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. I've interviewed her a couple of times. When she walked in the room, I felt her walk in the room because of her character. She has such a strength of character, I think, honed from being a prisoner in her home for years, hours and days of meditation, facing danger, reading deeply, thinking deeply. And everybody says that meets her, that she has this presence that you feel. If she walked in this room, you would feel her. But they also comment on what a wonderful sense of humor she has. And she does. She has the loveliest sense of humor. The first time I interviewed her, I was kind of smuggled in, and I told her I'd honed my questions to 20 questions in descending order of importance. As the truth was, I really thought I'd be arrested before I got through the questions. And she just looked at me and smiled mischievously, and she said, "20 questions? It sounds like a quiz show." In a very recent interview, a reporter asked if she were not afraid of being killed because the generals in charge of Burma had recently released a very public threat against her. They had said if she continued her efforts to bring democracy to Burma, that she would be in very grave danger, said that imprint in their government newspaper. And so a reporter asked if she needed a bodyguard, and she pointed to a puppy that her son had bought to her to keep her company. And she said, "Well, my puppy wags his tail when anybody comes up." She says, "Don't you think that will be enough, a wag of the tail?" She had learned, I think, too, that she who laughs, laughs. One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons was just a few weeks after September 11th, when everyone was so down and shaken and depressed and fearful and worried about the future. You remember that time, and at the time it seemed as if we would never laugh again. And after much debate, the New Yorker went ahead and ran this cartoon. I clip that out and I saved it. I laugh every time I see it. I think laughter is very therapeutic. Laughter heals, and there are lots of scriptures that recommend it, from Luke 6, blessed are you that hunger now, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you that weep now, for you shall laugh. A merry heart maketh a cheerful countenance. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he that is of a merry heart shall have a continual feast. Proverbs 17, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. Which brings me back to Julia Child. When I asked her the secret of a long life, she just roared with laughter and said, red meat and gin. Not politically correct, but actually theologically sound. It's up to us to choose joy and faith. If I were writing a headline for this talk, I would say, choose faith, choose laughter, find joy. So I will close with this last cartoon. My philosophy of life. Thank you very much.
Is this on?
Yep.
I am Sika. Sika Wan. If you've seen the spelling of my name, you might be puzzled as to how it's pronounced. The Z is actually soft, I tell people. So C instead of Z. And my other name is spelled K-A-R, but I'm from Boston, you see. So the R is, in fact, Bostonian. So simply Sika, Sika Wan. I'm trying to follow up on Rena's presentation. Oh, here it is. And it's going to be a tough sell. I think there's a handout coming around, so you all have that. I guess a couple of themes came to my mind, Rena, as you were talking. One is, in fact, the point of responsibility. How we're, in fact, connected to one another. We're not single, isolated individuals, but in fact, as Rena has been telling us, she would interview people, famous, infamous, not so famous people, and we are connected to them. Now, I'm a convert. I didn't grow up in a Christian family. I found the church extremely inviting, very attractive. I still do. Precisely because I would walk into the church and realize that we're all sisters and brothers. We go beyond our bloodline, our DNAs, and I would like to think we go beyond our ethnicity and race as well. They were all sisters and brothers in spite of who we are and how different we might be and what kind of different households we might be brought up in. So it's the church, it is the interconnectedness that I think Rena has helped me see, at least. So I want to actually look at a passage. I think it might be appropriate, but tell me if it is. And there will be a test at 1 o'clock, and evidently you'll be charged if you fail. Otherwise, the lunch is free. This is what Todd told me. So that's my passage. Now, I've actually taken the liberty of giving you the a handout. Lots and lots of words. Don't read them right now. I just want to show you a couple of things, all right? Now, first of all, let me just show you the sort of mainline favorite version of that, the New Revised Standard. This is it, all right? Now we commend you. This is Paul speaking. In fact, I think this is the whole point for writing this letter, Second Thessalonians, which is rather unknown, and I don't think you've ever heard a sermon on this passage yet. So this is the first one. Now, we command you, beloved, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, to keep away from believers who are living in idleness and not according to traditions, and so on. And you yourselves, verse 7, know how you ought to imitate us. We were not idle, same word again, all right, when we were with you. Now, if I would just jump ahead a little bit to verse 10 and 11. For even when we were with you, we gave you this command. Anyone unwilling to work should not eat. Right? No working, no eating. Right? Verse 11. For we hear that some of you are living in idleness. Same deal. Right? mere busybodies, not doing any works, and so on and so forth. Verse 12. Now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to do the work quietly and earn their own living. Right? Now that's the NRSV. Now I understand, the other important translation of that is actually in the New International Version. Now both versions, by the way, are actually on your handout. The NIV is actually the middle column. All right, same passage. Okay, verse 6. Now, I lost my pointer at the Highland Park United Methodist Church. If you see a black one with a sort of pointed top in the great room, let me know. I missed it a lot. Now, same deal, idleness in verse 6, all right? In verse 7, you yourself know that you ought to follow example, that we were not idle when we were with you. Okay? Now, verse 10. It's a command, this rule, if a man will not work, he shall not eat. Looks like a sort of a communal principle. I always tell my students, my Greek students, if you want to know a passage, translate the Greek or the Hebrew and translate the text literally. Something good will come out. Something you haven't seen before will come out. Just translate something literally. So I've done that. This is the third column on your handout, all right? A literal translation by Sika 1. All right, here we go. Now, this is wooden and almost unreadable, so don't try to read it. I just want to highlight the points of this passage. We command you, brothers, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep your distance from any brother behaving out of order. Where's idleness? Ain't there. All right? Verse 7. For you yourself know how you must imitate us because we did not act out of order. Same deal. All right? Which is translated in both versions we saw earlier as idle or idleness. Right? We did not eat bread from you free of charge, blah, 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 and so on. Verse 10. For we were with you, we were commanding you that if someone doesn't wish to work, don't let the person eat. Now, you understand, this is slightly different than don't let anybody who doesn't work eat. This is a command, right? Don't let anybody eat. Where are we? Verse 13. No, that's not what. Verse 12. To such ones we command and exhort in the name of Jesus Christ. The working in silence, they eat their own bread. Now, you understand, this is slightly different, or maybe more than slightly different, right? Now, out of order. I've just learned how to use PowerPoint, so I love these colors. Idleness is, in fact, out of order. Act out of order, same deal. I mentioned that both already. Even in verse 11. So three occurrences of this idleness. In fact, the original word actually meant out of order. So what's going on? Out of order, equal idle. I mean, how does that happen? The Greek is, in fact, atakatos, which appears twice in verse 6 and again in verse 11. Right, that's the adverb. And also ataktein in verse 7. That's the verb, all right? Of course, you can see even from the root, it really, really from the same word. Now, the word, the tak word, I suppose, was a military term. It meant marching in order. And, of course, once you add an A in front of it, like amoral, then you negate the original term, right? So, negated by the alpha, the A, okay? So the word little means marching, if you will, out of formation, out of order. So how do you get idleness out of this? Now, of course, the context is talking about idleness. It is talking about someone who's not working. Right? There's no problem with that. I mean, I don't think the translators are trying to pull a fast one on you. But how do you get from out of order to idleness? Right? More mystery. Verse 10. If someone doesn't wish to work, don't let the person eat. As I mentioned earlier, this is really much more of a command than a kind of principle, if you will. And furthermore, in verse 12, they're supposed to be working in silence. They eat their own bread. Their own bread. I mean, we're not talking about earn your own living. but in fact, they should eat their own bread. What exactly is happening? Now, of course, if I had the time, this is the time when I should get you to answer the question. We'll play some, I'll play Socrates for a few minutes. But we don't have the time, so let's look. No work, no food, right? Anyone unwilling to work should not eat. Now, that's, of course, in the NRSV, right? And it's a kind of recommended principle, if you will. That's the stress. Anyone who's not willing to work should not eat. But on the other hand, if a man will not eat, he should not eat. Will not work, I'm sorry, should not eat. That's NIV. And it sounds a little bit like a personal principle. This is what you are supposed to do. But in my own literal translation, if someone doesn't wish to work, don't let the person eat. This now becomes a kind of communal or community rule. Right? It's a commandment. Right? What is happening? Idleness is some form out of order. I think the assumption is this. The assumption is that the resources that pull together for sharing. And Paul is really talking about the freeloaders, sponging off the rest of the people. They're all supposed to be doing this all together. And of course, if you don't pull your own weight, then forget it. You're not supposed to eat. You're out of the loop, out of the community. If it was a kind of love communalism, this is what a German theologian has called it. Now, if you look at the biblical witnesses, in 2 Corinthians 8, 1 and, 12, 1 and 2, it actually, Paul actually talks about the Thessalonian church being of rock-bottom poverty. It's not a wealthy church. Right? They were trying to, Paul was trying to get them to contribute to Jerusalem. But in fact, says, well, they did. They're trying to make the Corinthians look bad because the Corinthian church was actually quite rather wealthy. So look, the Macedonian church, and in this case, of course, the Thessalonians, out of the rock-bottom poverty, they in fact gave, you see, the underlying assumption was, well, how about you? You know, this is what Todd does so well. You know, if someone else is giving, then are you giving as well? Right? It's a kind of a fundraising tactic. Well, that's what it is. Chapter 8 is, in fact, a fundraiser. Right? And so is chapter 9. Okay? Acts 2 to 4, same deal. Sharing of all things together. And, of course, in this case, what is one fatal flaw? What is one fatal flaw in communism? The freeloaders. Right? Why should I work if I'm going to get this, you know, regardless? Right? But of course, if the community is going to work, you've got to feel responsible for one another. Right? Each, in fact, works in the community and for others, which is why I entitled this, really responsibility for one another. And what we do on our own, in fact, affects the others. And is, in fact, the responsibility for the entire, for the whole community. Right? Not just for ourselves. And if we shirk our responsibility, then we can no longer be a part of the community. You'll be kicked out of the community. But the idea, of course, is that we're responsible for one another. We're all interconnected. Now, I'm really a confusion, not confused, but Confucian Christian. And I believe that there is an interconnectedness of all things and all beings. The idea, which doesn't quite work, and that is for a person to become so virtuous that he, unfortunately, is always a he, is very androcentric, will become a king so that I can be a sage and I can save the entire world and bring, finally, peace to my community, to my country, finally, to bring peace on earth. 平天下. I mean, that's the highest form of Confucianism. Now, I do believe that somehow our virtue can emanate beyond ourselves, and then we can begin to affect those around us. But you see, the underlying assumption here is that we're all connected to one another, that we don't live simply for ourselves, that we live for one another. On the other hand, the punishment, if you take advantage of the community, you'll be moved out. I mean, it is really a fairly harsh commandment. Let you then eat your own bread. That is to say, you can no longer share with the rest of us. because it was really, you was really sponging off of us. Then you have to eat your own bread. You're no longer part of the community, but that we are now, in fact, have to be responsible for ourselves and others. Thank you very much.